Okay, we are going to be looking into Acts chapter 12 this morning. Before we do, I'd like to one more time have you look at the screen to discuss the family of Herod the Great and generations of rulers in Israel after Herod the Great, who is, of course, maybe most notoriously known for being the king that had attempted to slay Jesus in his infancy by killing the babies in Bethlehem. Now, this particular map, obviously you won't be able to see much on this, but hopefully you can see there's a darker area here that's in green, and that green runs up well outside of the territory of Israel, and then through Galilee, Samaria, Judea, and Idumea down here. All this green area that you see, which excludes this piece right in here, was the fullest extent that Herod the Great was able to rule over. Now, in the next map, which is the same area right there, and I'm just going to take that, what's the word for that, right? The legend, right? The legend. I thought it was a funny word for that. A legend is a thing that's not necessarily true, and then they call this a legend, you know, who tells you what it is exactly. But what you've got here is, again, a map that now shows Herod's kingdom, but after his death is designating these areas. This light blue here is called Decapolis. Herod never ruled over that. That was that section I was showing you earlier that he did not rule over, and his sons did not as well. This is territory that was given to Herod Philip. So at the death of Herod the Great, the kingdom was kind of divided up, and his son Philip takes over this pink area that you have here up to the northeast. The green area was given to Herod Antipas. Now, he's got this little bit right here, but for some unknown reason, he was given a separated area down there, too. So it must have been kind of misery for him, trying to rule over two areas that aren't even connected to one another. And then there was some territory given to Archelaus, which was the guy that while Jesus and his parents, and he very young, were down in Egypt, when Herod died, this guy Archelaus got this area, and he was such a nasty guy that they were afraid he'd never come back into his territory. Excuse me. So, all we're doing here now is to show the descendants of Herod and how his kingdom was breaking up. Now, I know you're probably not going to be able to see these areas here, but I just wanted to point them out. These smaller areas within the general area that these guys are ruling, this is called Ituria, this is Trachonitis, this is Arnonitis, Batania, the capitals we've already talked about, Perea, and then Idumea, are areas that you will either read about in Luke chapter 3, for instance, that are mentioned just passingly, in your Bible, or areas that are also mentioned in, for instance, Josephus, who is a first century historian and writes about the times of the first century, especially. And so I just want to familiarize yourself with these terms: Ituria, Trachonitis, Arnonitis, Batania, Decapolis, Perea, and Idumea are names that you're going to be hearing in your studies quite a bit. They are not regions that are far-flung all over, you know, the Roman Empire. They're names you want to try to remember because they are directly related to events that take place in Bible times. And so we kind of get the idea sometimes that Israel is Israel, and so, you know, that's just one territory right there, and we usually think of it as being everything that's on the west side of the Jordan River, and so therefore you find your Dead Sea, your Sea of Galilee, and just draw a line, you know, and that's Israel, and that's what we're talking about in the Bible. It's not the case. There's far-flung territories, all this green area, most of this blue area, all of this pink area, that is a part of the Bible history. It's a part of the Bible peoples. It bears directly on Bible events. You know, we always think about everything from here this way as just being on the Gentiles. It's really not the case. Huge numbers of Jews that live in these areas. These Jews are ruled by Jewish kings who are appointed by the Romans, and they're intimately involved in the events that take place here. And so when Jesus and the apostles begin preaching, these areas are in short order also going to be receiving gospel. Gospel's going out, you know, in all directions, not just, you know, here and then that way. Maybe can't think of them for some time. And one of these areas I also want to point out is called Idumea. Idumea is a region in the far south of what we classically describe as being Israel. But Herod the Great was from this region of Idumea. And he was not a full-blooded, you know, Jew. He's half. And as a result, he comes out of this territory. Herod and his kingdom, along with his sons and his grandsons, always had a kind of cloud hanging over them. They wanted to be accepted as Jews, and so they had a lot of pull with the Romans because they were half and half, but it also made them only half and half with the Jews. So there's always tension, always tension, always problems going on between not just the Romans, but with this Herod family too. So, what is a Herodian? When you read about the Herodians, what are you reading about? You're reading about this family and its mixture of being only kind of half and half Jewish and Roman, and then taking over up here throughout all of Israel and Gentile territory as well, so that a Herodian becomes somebody who, in the political instability of the time, sides with the Herod family. The Herodians decided, let's just go with the flow, you know, we'll take that. There were a lot, zealots particularly, who said, no, you know, we have to be more faithful to our God and to Israel, and we shouldn't be accepting us and all of this, and so they made for a lot of instability. And one last thing on this chart, and we'll be done with this one. This area down here in the green, I don't know why he tilted it, it's called Judea, and then Samaria and Galilee. These are the three regions that we think about the most. These are the three regions, the southern part, the central part, and the northern part of Israel, that we more classically, again, think of as being Israel. So, yes, there's Judea, there's Samaria, there's Galilee, but these others are really very important to us, too. And so, this particular Herod that we're talking about in chapter 12, isn't even on the chart. He's a grandson, not a son. When these kingdoms, the areas, broke up after Herod had ruled all this, you see this line right here, the extent of Herod's kingdom. So Herod's kingdom is like this. Does not include the blue. Goes up like this, around like that. That's Herod's kingdom. It gets divided on his death. Then, these guys have all kinds of intrigues and stuff that goes on. And when chapter 12 shows up in the book of Acts, you've got another Herod. But it's Herod Agrippa the first. There'll be another one. And this Herod is a grandson, not a son. And this Herod will have control of all of this region. And this Herod will have the largest extent of land control of any of the Herods. And so, oddly enough, while you always speak of Herod the Great, because he started all of this and gained a lot of territory and all, Herod's grandson, Agrippa the First, Herod Agrippa the First, only mentioned in chapter 12, actually has the largest holdings that any Herod will ever have. So at this moment, when he decides to kill James in the start of the chapter, and does, and then wants to kill Peter, but fails, because he miraculously escapes from his prison, these events are taking place at the very pinnacle of Herodian rule. That is then going to be shrinking in the years that are to come. And so this Herod that we talked about last week has more power, has more land, has tremendous influence in Rome and all of that. At this moment, he is the king of Israel. And he's going to persecute Christians. Excuse me. Okay. Still struggling with the allergies and whatnot, but actually feeling a lot better here this morning. All right, so enough on all that. And let's turn then over to chapter 12 itself. We got down through verse 17 last week, where Peter is miraculously released from prison. He humorously tries to go to John Mark's mother's house, and Rhoda won't let him in. She's so excited. But he's discovered, yeah, in fact, it is him, you know, that's out there. He briefly speaks with him, you know, tell everybody I'm free, and then he bolts. He leaves, it's unspoken, but apparently because, as now a prison escapee, not knowing what's going to happen next, you know, he could be a terrible threat, a danger for all these new Christians that he loves so much. And so he's leaving them. And we do not know where he goes. Many people believe, and it's not possible really to know, that he left this entire region altogether. Some suggest he preached in one part of the Roman Empire, some suggest others. The Catholics want us to believe that he went to Rome and became the first pope, you know, and all that, which is that, you know, just certainly not the case. But he does just disappear. We are at the hinge of the book of Acts. Up to this point, Peter has been the main character. He is the guy around which everything is revolving. Jerusalem has been the principal city, though we have gotten into some other areas here. And in chapter 10 and 11, our first Gentile family have become Christians in Caesarea. But mostly, I've got it covered up in green right here, Jerusalem right there. Jerusalem has been the center. Jews have been the only people really that we're dealing with. And we've had Peter as the main character. Peter now will disappear for the next three chapters. He will be briefly mentioned, just a couple of verses in chapter 15, and then he's gone from the pages, you know, of the book of Acts altogether. And what happens is that to the far north in the city of Antioch, which is anywhere near here, it's up in Syria, Paul, though at this point he's still called Saul, is the central player for the rest of the book. The Gentiles, not the Jews, are the central people. And Antioch of Syria is the beginning and ending place of all of Paul's travels. Every journey he takes starts there, and except for the last one when he winds up in prison in Rome, ends there. So, we're about to abandon, brethren, this region right here. Chapter 15, they'll come down to the conference in Jerusalem, but, you know, that's kind of an aside. We're done. The gospel has swept through this area. The gospel in the last 14 years has been extremely successful in this area. And then shortly, we're going to turn the page, and we're going off to the world. So we'll be looking in just a moment at the start of the first missionary journey. A bunch of maps on that. We'll look at those later. But from Jerusalem, where the gospel began, and Luke said it would in the gospel. When he writes the companion book of Acts, he said the gospel would start here. It did. It went to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and now we're up here in Antioch. We're going to have the start of this first journey and all the others, and the gospel is going to be sweeping across now all of this territory, so by the time we get to the end of the book of Acts, Paul's up here in prison in the capital city of both Italy and the empire. So, we've been really very limited. The first Gentiles were right there. See? Not very far. But now we're shifting everything up here. This becomes the headquarters and the center. And everything now is sweeping across what we now call Turkey, into Greece and Macedonia, and on in to Italy and the rest of the empire. Okay, so in chapter 12, in at verse 18, when day came, there was no small disturbance among the soldiers as to what could have become of Peter. How many soldiers are particularly no small disturbed? Okay. Now, Carol said four. How many is it?
16.
16. Carol's right, because it'd be four of them that were actually there, you know, one on the outside of the door, one on the inside. Carol's absolutely right. But we were told that it was not just one squad, there were four squads of soldiers, and so three other groups of four would also be particularly upset because they were, all 16, specifically charged with taking care of Paul, and one group of four, you know, were at the cell itself. himself, I mean, as close as you could get. The other's probably, you know, and then sleeping, I guess. And so, a total of 16 are going to be particularly upset. But really, it's going to upset the whole prison, isn't it? Those 16 guys are not the whole jail, and so there's going to be a whole lot of soldiers that are upset. Some here, you know, a number really particularly concerned. Why are they so distressed? Do you folks know why it is? I mean, beyond the obvious that they've lost their prisoner, but why is it that losing a prisoner is such a bad deal? They'll lose their lives. Why will they lose their lives? Okay, now Ron's got it exactly right. Esther.
Dereliction of duty.
Okay, yeah, it's either a dereliction or at least a failure of duty. Now, you're all absolutely right. I just want to fine-tune it just a little bit. In the Roman system, if you're charged with taking care of a prisoner, you become immediately at risk for the prisoner's punishment or penalty if you lose him. So, the reason I wanted to just fine-tune it, you're all exactly right, but it would depend on what sentence the guy was facing. And in this case, this sentence would have been a death penalty. It's so urgent, you got 16 soldiers that have been assigned, you know, specifically to him. So the loss of this one guy involving a death penalty means that the soldiers charged with taking care of him are themselves under a death penalty, not some other penalty, because this particular thing is considered a capital offense. So consequently, you know, the death penalty falls on them. Had they been charged with a prisoner who was facing some other penalty, not actually all the way up to and including death, you know, then that penalty would have been incumbent upon them. So they got reasonably well set. Michael? It is a good sense, so I like it too. It goes back to the way Ron described it. It's an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You know, the Romans aren't using the Jewish system, which continued that actual statement. But, you know, that is the idea. And yeah, it would get your full attention, wouldn't it? You know? And then, also, people would just be more careful about the charges that they level too, because not only were the soldiers charged with this, but if you accuse somebody in a court, and it's been proven that this is a frivolous lawsuit or that you are lying about it, what happens to you? It was the same deal. You know, then what you were expecting to get out of the other person suddenly, you know, comes from you. You're going to pay those court costs, but you're also going to pay, you know, the actual loss of life, the penalty. And again, there's a lot to come in that system. You know, most people in the nation like that one too. Alright, so, that being said, then, you know, we got the setting. So we go pretty quickly now, it's pretty straightforward, but when Herod had searched for him and had not found him in 19, he examined the guards and ordered that they be led away. And he went down from Judea to Caesarea and was spending time there. Now the verse just says, led away. What were they led away to, Bruce? Exactly, and this word actually, and I don't know the word itself, but reading in the commentaries, they say that the word more even strongly than implies, you know, it is contained within the word, that they went through the judicial process. It wasn't just that he called them and said, hey, what do you guys think? You know, it was the full weight of the jurisprudence of the Romans, which includes all the things that you've just mentioned. So their examination would have been a pretty rough thing to undergo. And then, you know, they got no answers. What's the only thing they could say?
We don't know. Well, we don't know. You know, it's a miracle. And Peter himself had to come to himself. You know, what is this? You know, so it's just awesome. A miracle. There's no explanation for it. They're just tongue-tied, and they lose their lives.
Now, how many men lost their lives? And this goes back to the 4 and then the 16 we were talking about a while ago. We don't know. We don't know. Maybe Herod put to death the 4. Maybe Herod put to death all 16. You know, we don't know. And so, either way, It's a strange thing for us, and that's why I'm not going to spend any much time on it. It seems to be just ultimately unfair to these soldiers, doesn't it? I mean, God knew that he's going to miraculously rescue Peter. There isn't anything these soldiers can do about it. They weren't responsible in any way for what was going on here. They're just doing their duty. You know, very really just doing their duty. You know, and then God miraculously rescues Peter, and the next thing you know, they're led off to execution. Okay? Now, I know that is a struggle for us. Okay? The only thing I'll add to help, you know, with all of this is, question. We are so eager to use the word innocent in our society as we view almost everything. It just drives me crazy. We're always saying these innocent soldiers, you know, were killed. And whoever is attacking the Bible, they just love this story. What kind of a God? You want to serve a God like that? Look how unfair this is, how unjust this is. You know, why would you want to serve somebody and treat these guys like this? Not their fault, you know. And so, yeah, you know, great arguments here today. But stop, wait a minute. Are these soldiers innocent? According to Romans 3, is anybody innocent? Innocent? I don't know who these guys are. And so maybe they were guilty of heinous crimes that we, you know, can't imagine. And soldiers, not just in our time, you know, run amok. We hear about it all the time. And, you know, it's been the case since the beginning of time. And so I don't know what these guys are guilty of. In God's sight, anybody who's sinned, you and I included, is worthy of death. They may have been worthy of death many times over for terrible crime. You know, we don't know. So to say they're innocent, be careful. They're innocent of what? Now, granted, they are innocent in one sense. What are they innocent of? They're innocent of, you know, a dereliction of duty under Roman law. Yeah, they can't fight a miracle. But nobody is innocent, you know, ever. And so don't accuse God of doing something wrong here. His wisdom, he deemed this to be just and right and fair, and we don't know any of the circumstances surrounding it. These men may, you know, be well worthy of the death sentence that they suffered. Carol?
When it says that they were led away, we don't know how many were led, were punished, or how they, we really don't know how they were punished. I mean, couldn't he have decided that he didn't want to punish them and send them to
We don't think so because of our knowledge of the Roman system. And we're really pretty confident, you know, the commentators and historians are saying, you know, it's really pretty certain that they got killed. It doesn't say killed, but that led away is very ominous.
Okay.
Yeah, I know it does, but it's an italicized thing. It does not say that in the original text. That's just supposition. Yeah, but a tomb detail isn't subject to a death penalty. So that's just a tomb detail. So they fail. And there, they were probably punished pretty severely because as soldiers you should be. But you know, it wouldn't carry capital punishment. And by the way, no army is really frivolously throwing soldiers away either. You don't like to kill your soldiers. It's kind of counterproductive. And so, you know, it takes pretty severe circumstances for that to happen. But the thing about it, you've got an entire prison. You've got them in the most secure cell that there is. You've detailed 16 guys to one prisoner. You've got two of them that are chained to him, and you've got two of them that are right outside the door. And these guys, you know, all failed, and so did the whole rest of the jail, because door after door, as you're leaving, you know, and the last one opens of its own accord, you know, the whole jail system has failed. And so this is a pretty serious deal, isn't it? That's a major failure of the entire system. And so it's highly unlikely, I think, that they can escape with their lives. So certainly not the two that are in the cell. Most, you know, I think certainly not the next two. I think four went down anyway. There may have been quite a few more. Now, I saw a hand out, I think, was next. Oh, no, yeah, there you are, okay. All right, yeah. What you guys need to do, you all need to sit as close as you can
Because when you raise your hand, people in the front who've got their hands up don't know you're back there.
Go forward and develop the other hand.
Okay, over here. Go. Yeah, that's right, but it is italicized in my book too, and that's just a matter, you know, I have led away two executions, but the two executions in italics, it's not in the original. The particular one that you have decided not to do that there, but it really is applied. So, it just depends on the translation conventions of the particular book you've got. Alright, so anyway, whatever happened to these guys, it was bad. And a lot of them apparently suffered the thing. Not unjust in God's part at all, but it sure gets everybody's attention. So now we are introduced to a new thought. He then, in the last part of 19, went down from Judea to Caesarea and was spending time there. So from Jerusalem, he goes over to Caesarea, which is the favorite place for these Roman rulers to be living. They like the seaport there, had a great palace and all of that right there. He goes down here. Josephus, the uninspired historian, born about the time of Jesus, who is a Pharisee and a Jew living in these times and who writes about these times, tells us in his uninspired history about that journey. And that's one of the other ways, not only when the famine occurred at the end of chapter 11, but when we have these men as rulers, and now this journey are all confirmed in uninspired history as well. So, you know, it's even your atheist believes that this journey took place. And so he goes to Caesarea in verse 19. Then it says in 20, he was angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon, and with one accord they came to him, and having won over Blastus, the king's chamberlain. A chamberlain is a man who is charged with the responsibility for the king's very bedroom. He's the guy that is your most highly trusted servant. Tremendous power and influence. You believe in this guy. He's got the keys to your bedroom door. And so they went to him and they won him over, it says, and they were asking for peace because their country was fed by the king's country. Tyre and Sidon is up here in this region right here. Tyre and Sidon, maybe I should go back to the previous one. Tyre and Sidon are Tyre and Sidon. They're in the region we call Phoenicia. And they're outside of Herod's immediate jurisdiction. But this dude is powerful. He's mad. And this territory here does not produce all that much food. So, they were dependent on the wheat fields of Galilee. Much trade is taking place here. And somehow they made Herod mad. So mad that the suspicion is he had declared that he was just going to go to war with them. He had it entirely. So it wasn't just a matter of, we're not going to sell you our food anymore. It was, I've had it, I'm coming to take you guys out and absorb you into my kingdom. Well, they realized they didn't have a chance. They depended on him for the food to begin with. They hardly had an army that could beat him. So they had so fouled up, you know, that he's going to wipe us out, apparently. So what are we going to do? Well, court intrigue, go to Blastus. And in verse 21, on an appointed day, Herod, having put on his royal apparel, took his seat on the rostrum and began delivering an address to them. And the people kept crying out, "The voice of a god and not of a man." And immediately an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give God the glory. And he was eaten by worms and died. But the word of the Lord continued to grow and to be multiplied. And Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had fulfilled their mission, taking along with them John, who was also called Mark. Now, let's go back to this one. Okay, so here's Jerusalem, here's Caesarea. And what takes place is
Soldiers die because of the miraculous freedom of Peter, who now disappears for the next three chapters and a couple of verses in chapter 15. He's gone for good out of the book of Acts. Herod Agrippa I goes to Caesarea. Both the Bible and Josephus tell us about it. Josephus, in very great detail, tells us about this event. Really interesting. And Josephus also says that a day came in Caesarea, but he tells us where it took place. It took place, I should have got your picture, in that big theater that we talked about previously, and that I had a whole lesson on Sunday night, so I showed you a ton of pictures of that beautiful theater there. Herod had his box seats, you know, the best seats in the house, surrounded by all these people, and that's the rostrum that he got up on. And he was apparently fit as a fiddle. And he was wearing a jacket a lot like this one. Kind of shiny, isn't it? Okay. So, but what he had done was he had one that I don't know if you'd call it sequins or if it was woven with, you know, actual silver or what it was. But Josephus describes it as being highly reflective. So it got my beat by a far cry. And as he's standing there in this full sunlight, every move that he makes is just sending, you know, beams of sunshine flashing all around. He's really putting on quite a show. And he was speaking at length. So he was apparently healthy and happy, you know, everything was fine. And then Josephus also tells us, and suddenly, in the midst of all these people crying out that he's a god and not a man and all of that, he just crumples. But Josephus also tells us it took him 5 days to die. This verse does not say that he just fell over dead. It says he was eaten of worms and died. Josephus, you know, tells us that right there in the midst of this deal, he suddenly falls ill and can't finish. He then spends 5 days in unbelievable agony while he's eaten up from inside, and then he dies 5 days later. And it's one of those marvelous, you know, moments in world history where we have such intricately dovetailed historical record from both the Bible and from uninspired history. That we have loads of these, you know, to begin with, but it's just another one in such detail, so that one recognizes never, ever doubt the historical accuracy of your Bible. If it says a thing took place, it took place. If it says a miracle happened, then a miracle happened. And if you can't find it recorded, you know, somewhere else in uninspired history, it doesn't matter, because we've got tons and tons of these, and this is one of the most detailed of them all, they are confirmed from Old Testament and New, you know, in uninspired history. So, this guy met a terrible end precisely as the Bible says that he did. And with his death, it says in verse 24 that the word of the Lord continued to grow and to be multiplied. And Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they fulfilled their mission. That's the end of chapter 11, this relief of the saints. Taking along with him John, who was also called Mark, who's the son of a woman whose house that Peter went to in Jerusalem. So they march all the way back up the coast here to the city of Antioch. I forget for sure right now, but I think it's about 300 miles. I believe it's 300 miles. 300 miles, they go back up to Antioch, and the stage is set for chapter 13. And when the page turns, Saul takes center stage, and Saul's journeys throughout the Roman Empire become what we're going to talk about. So, any comment or question about this first section? It's not quite half the book, it's 28 chapters, so we need to get to chapter 14 to get to the middle, but pretty close to the middle of the book. Any comment or question on chapter 12? Because we're going to chapter 13, verse 1 now. Scene completely changes, our emphasis changes, everything changes. Any thoughts about chapter 12 or 11 or 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1? Okay, wait.
Is the James in verse 17, is that the Lord's brother?
Thought not. Different one. John Mark, not. But he is
writer of the gospel, apparently the guy that fled, you know, in the arrest of Jesus. Okay? And consequently, quite a guy, because as you can see, he does a fair amount of traveling with Paul and Barnabas. So he knows what he's talking about, not only because he's inspired to do it, but he's an eyewitness as well. Okay, all right. So, now back to the mass, everybody, because I've got several ways to go about this, and I thought today, knowing you wouldn't be able to get very deep into chapter 13, knowing, too, the pace I hope is going to pick up quite a bit, that I would try to really immerse your mind in the maps of this first journey. So I've outlined in red, a different atlas is going to zoom in on that area. Here is that C-shaped journey. Outward bound, he goes out here like this, turns around, visits the very same city, and comes on back. The distance across here is about 125 miles or so. Distance from here to here is about 100 miles, so you can kind of start, you know, adding up how far he went. It's like 90 miles here, about 80 miles here. There's a whole lot of travel. And we don't know the exact route, so I can't put an actual number of how many miles they traveled, but it's hundreds and hundreds of miles. A lot of it by boat, a lot of it on foot, you know, hard travel and all of that. Here, though, is this region of Phoenicia we were talking about where Tyre and Sidon is. And so they averted their war by winning over Blast and King Chamberlain. Go ahead, Rachel.
Is that area, is that Mesopotamia?
I can't hear what you're saying, Rachel. Is Syria where what was?
Mesopotamia.
Mesopotamia's over here.
Oh.
Okay. Don't you feel so silly? Why people are afraid to raise their hands. Don't be afraid to raise your hand. I do this constantly. Make those kind of mistakes. Yeah, that's right, there's Mesopotamia. The region between the rivers. Here's the one river, here's the other river, this is the Euphrates, this is just the tail of the Tigris when we come down here. You know, these are the areas that we think of as modern-day Iraq. And Syria's pretty well still got the same region that it did before, and that's why I think they've got Mesopotamia and then over here. We're in Antioch right here. I was surprised, I guess I didn't realize, when I showed you the pictures of Antioch, by the way, that, you know, I said, here's the Orontes River, here's a picture of where the Orontes River goes into the bay. And Antioch is the seaport of the Mediterranean on the Orontes River. You know, that's fine. But you remember a couple times when I was showing you that picture, I would say, so if you over here to the right, it's upstream a little bit. Well, I didn't realize it's actually about 40 miles upstream. So you had a big, deep, navigable river, and, you know, they were 40 miles away from the actual coastline itself. But here's the Antioch of Syria. Now, on this map, again, I just want to give you several different visual hits on how this looks. It's like a sea, is what it's like. It is, you know, one outward bound course that's retraced almost exactly when you come back in again. It takes us into the region that we know as modern-day Turkey. But here, shaded in green, Asia, what we sometimes refer to as Asia Minor, is this area in Bible times. They were calling it Asia. We, of course, think of the Far East as being Asia now. We're assigning a different Asia. But this is the Asia Minor of the time. Phrygia, Pisidia, Pamphylia, and Galatia, Bithynia, Pontus, and Cappadocia are all areas that are going to be mentioned in other Bible books where letters are going to be sent up there. Paul's going to write to Galatia. Peter's going to mention Bithynia, Pontus, and Cappadocia. So I really like this map because it highlights, you know, larger letters these areas. But it shows us that in God's wisdom, the first time he decided to go outside of the immediate area of Israel, he starts in a Gentile city as his headquarters. And he sends them out to, you know, major important islands strategically and economically, and, you know, one that's going to get a tremendous amount of trade throughout the rest of the Roman Empire. And then he takes them up right through the heart of this region where your main roads would be either coastal or inland. But it's just a wonderfully strategically brilliant way to
so that from each of these various locations, the gospel again can be spreading out into these other regions. So this little slice that you see right here in this C shape is going to have a profound impact on the Roman Empire. A tremendous number of people doing a lot of traveling to its furthest reaches that we get into. Okay, that's if there's anything else I want to say about this one. Oh yeah, and then remember that much like we have a lot of Herods, we've also got a lot of Antiochs. And these two, the Antioch of Syria and the Antioch of Pisidia, those two, very different in a long ways apart. You know, so when you read Antioch, you always have to stop and think, oh, look at that, Hank is here today. Heart attack and everything, back in the hospital. You can see there, Hank. Okay, somebody else had a hand up. Sandra. Can't tell you. See, I don't know. I just truly don't know. Now, Paul later is going to do two more journeys and then a trip to Rome, look at the Roman account, but in these other two journeys, he's going to get into the general area there, too. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe it just is for this region right here, it can fan out like that. So he felt like, well, okay, I'm kind of making these people can go this way, and these people can go that way, and God, you know, I just don't know. Okay, almost done. Just a couple of minutes left, obviously. But now, you know, we're going to zoom in on a different atlas that's zooming in even a little tighter on just the journey itself. My idea here, I know it's an overload, but I'm hoping repetition. Some of you being very visual learners, others of you, you know, being more, you know, technical, I guess. You know, but by giving you a lot of different ones, I'm just hoping to bury this data. And then in the future, we'll more briefly refer to these. So we're kind of just getting a real foundation built. Then all this traveling, hopefully, will be taking shape through our study in these months to come, and it'll stick a little better for you. So here's an even tighter and more detailed map that shows us what he did. We're in Antioch of Syria. We are told he will go to Seleucia, which is the actual on-the-coast seaport for Antioch. They're going to sail over here to the city of Salamis on the island of Cyprus. It's about a 100-mile journey. The main road was known to be down here to get over to Paphos. So it's not like they got on a jet, flew straight, only on a superhighway, cut through the mountains. And notice how mountainous this region is. Really energetic. You get a lot of work to do to get over to Paphos. And when they get to Paphos, this is where Sergius Paulus is going to be. He's the main Roman guy there, who is also attested in uninspired history. Then, they're going to sail up here to Perga, where on this green line right here, I zoomed in on a larger map, John Mark is going to bail them. When John Mark, you know, says I can't handle it, or for whatever reason leaves, he makes Paul pretty unhappy. He's going to be mad about it at the end of chapter 15. He doesn't want to travel with him anymore after this. So John makes a really big decision, and Paul thinks it's a major failure on his first mission, and he bails. So Barnabas and Paul continue up here to Antioch and Pisidia. Now this journey is probably mostly along the river. It'll be, you know, lowlands. Maybe not so tough right there, but then you're back into the mountains. You got all kinds of mountains coming to Iconium and Lystra and Derbe, and then he's going to turn around and go back to each of those cities. And when he does, he's going to be appointing elders, he's confirming their faith. So these guys get double doses right there. Then he comes on down to my belly. Then he comes on down to Analia, forget Analia, and sails on back here to Antioch. Let me take an extra minute here, because I've got one more map. I can't do it. I'll do it next week. Okay, so we'll end with that. It is a big C-shaped journey, or a little C-shaped journey. That is arduous. It's going to take them a couple of years. And in the process, a tremendous amount of work is going to happen in the heart of the Gentile teaching is going to take place here. Then in subsequent journeys, we're going to do the same thing farther out. This is just going to be full of wonderful adventures. Take two whole chapters to tell us about it. It's the shortest of all the journeys. But there are two whole chapters devoted to it, so we're going to get a whole lot of information. So for today, the takeaway, we have turned the page, and Jerusalem's out of the picture now, not such a big deal. Peter's disappeared, and Jews are not so significant. We'll go to them first in every town, but it's the Gentiles that we're primarily going to go to. And then Saul, whose name will be changed to Paul next week in chapter 13, he becomes this main figure for the evangelization of the Roman Empire. Okay, we'll close right there without even a final prayer.